Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is host Richard Benulli. Today is Monday, December 16th, and today we have Alex Craner. He's the author and founder of Craner Analytics and former hedge fund manager. Welcome, Alex.
Thank you for having me, Richard. Good to join you today.
Great. I thought we'd begin with your global macro view on the economy and the financial markets.
Sure. I think that the picture is not all that complicated at the moment. I think all of the Western world is drowning in unpayable debts. And, there are too many ways out of that. There's a conceivable possibility of growing out of debt, which is unfortunately not realistic for most nations in the world. In fact, it's not realistic for any nations in the world because the debts are far, far, far too large. Then there's a possibility of default. And one of the ways of defaulting is inflation. And then there's a possibility of having a sharp deleveraging with a deflationary depression. Politically, the only palatable way out is through inflation. That is the only way that gives the ruling establishment maneuvering space to finagle, to delay the day of reckoning and to try to accomplish their agendas to as much as possible before people realize what's going on, because if you go for a rapid deleveraging and you end up with a deflationary depression, the system grinds to a halt almost from one day to the next. In a very rapid succession, you see massive job losses, businesses failing, so government services starting to fail, shortages starting to appear in the markets and so forth. With inflation, it's 2%, 3%, 4%, 5% inflation. It takes a while for people to realize what's going on, to start feeling the pain. The pain comes on very gradually. Politicians get to talk about this and that and stabilization and investments and getting the growth going. And, people wait for elections. And maybe if we vote for the other guys next time, it'll be better. And it gives the political class a little bit more maneuvering space to manage the crisis rather than being overwhelmed by it. And so I think that what we can look forward to in a country in places like Great Britain, EU, Japan, United States, Canada, Australia, pretty much all of the Western world, is that we're going to have accelerating inflation over the years. It's not possible to predict exactly how fast the onset will be, how long it will last, how severe the destruction of currency's purchasing power will be. But I think that's pretty much a certainty, which means that we are going to be seeing much, much higher commodity prices, gold, silver, energy, other metals, food. We're going to see higher interest rates. So we're going to have a decline in the value of treasury bonds. And I believe that we will also see asset prices continue to rise, i.e. the stock markets are going to be continuing their bull run. And I think that the reason for this is because at a given point in time, to manage the crisis, the governments are obliged to flood the system with liquidity. And what happens is that as people see inflation emerging, they realize that the currency is beginning to lose value faster and faster. And so they're going to be wanting to get rid of the currency. And, you know, one of the places where you can get rid of the currency and acquire real assets is the stock market. So we see that it's a symptomatic thing in these types of crises. And we've seen it in, you know, places like Zimbabwe in 2008, 2009. We've seen it in Argentina. We've seen it in Venezuela. It's not as, you know, a rising stock market is not necessarily a sign of everything going well in the economy. It's the sign that people are increasingly losing their confidence in the currency and are trying to get rid of it as soon as possible.
Yeah, those are great points. And we consider you one of the world's leading experts on the intersection between geopolitics and the economy and the financial markets. Can you give us some perspective on your current thoughts for geopolitical risks around the world as they relate to potential risks on the economy and the financial markets?
Sure. Well, we see that, you know, normally markets like stability and predictability, which is something that we are losing today because the geopolitical risks are rife. Things are getting worse. I don't know if they will improve with Donald Trump's administration, but I can't think how they could get any worse with the current administration. I think that Europe is going to continue on their collective suicide mission. You know, money is going to flow by the hundreds of billions of dollars into quote unquote defense spending at the expense of the you know, normal civilian economy. That's going to exacerbate commodity prices. One of the things that I'm worried about right now is that, you know, what NATO nations have been discussing for several months now, in fact, is that one of the ways that they can harm Russia is by attacking their so-called shadow tanker fleet. Because the Russians, to avoid, you know, to avoid the effects of Western sanctions, they have purchased literally, I think, between 200 and 300 oil tankers. And, you know, they insured these tankers outside of the Western markets, outside of the London insurance market. And the talk of NATO countries attacking Russian shadow tanker fleet is, what they mean is actually physically attacking them and sinking them. And we've seen just yesterday or day before yesterday, the Ukrainians produced a database of these tankers, the names, the descriptions, tonnage, and so forth. So I think this is something that's actually in the work, actually in the plans. What might happen is if Western powers start sinking, or I don't know, maybe otherwise disabling Russian tankers, then the Russians will be in the right to retaliate. And if that happens, then we might see oil prices start to move sharply higher, because we might see interruption to oil trade around the world. We might see shortages of oil and oil products, and that will push the oil prices much, much higher. So this is something that's worrying me in particular now, because energy is so very important to all of the world's developed economies. And so, you know, this could be the element that actually catalyzes the commodity price inflation, because if oil goes up, then a lot of other things go up as well. So this is what I'm very, very worried about. And then, you know, I also look at the bigger picture in the sense that, you know, we have this conflict between the Western world and the new emerging multipolar world led by Russia and China. And you know, there's this commodity super cycle hypothesis, which says that, you know, around 2021, 2022, commodity prices have reached a 50-year low with respect to equities. So if you take the ratio of commodity prices to equity prices, for the last 150 years, it's gone in these very, very large cycles that last about 25 years. And we are now even after the commodity price rally in 2022, we are still very, very low in that. So off the top of my head, I think that we hit not Bloomberg commodity price ratio, but a Goldman Sachs commodity price index and S&P 500, I think the ratio hit something like 0.5. And the peak values are at around 5-6. So that means either the commodity prices over the next 10-20 years go up by a factor of 10, or the equity price is correct, or both things happen. But here's a big problem in that the whole 150 years time series that we have on this relationship is still under the primacy of the Western world. And Western powers have had a strategy of keeping commodity producing countries around the world poor by design, deliberately, so that they don't develop their domestic economies, and that their domestic economies don't compete for the commodities that they produce, that they don't create their own domestic demand for, you know, whatever it be, coffee, cocoa, oil, gas, gold, uranium, whatever they produce. And now we have the emergence of China, and Chinese have a very, very different strategy. Namely, what they want to do is they want all these countries around the world, the commodity exporters, to be affluent societies. They want their people to become consumers for finished, refined products. And China has positioned itself as a global manufacturing hub. So they want to see, you know, billions of affluent people around the world who might be buying Chinese products. And so I think that this strategy, to the extent that it's successful, and so far it has been quite successful, is going to push up, you know, it's going to exert an upward pressure on commodity prices. Is going to be quite off the charts of what we've known over the last century and a half and longer. So, you know, what I'm saying is that over the next, let's call it quarter century, we might see commodity prices reach heights that we, you know, we couldn't predict today, but it could be a lot higher than what anybody could forecast today.
Yeah, I see the same thing, even not just the manufacturing in China, but reaching out with consulting services, engineering services, like in Saudi Arabia, right, for a nuclear reactor development there, but by the Chinese, Indonesia, I think, as well, for mining operations there, right, helping out. So I think they're beginning to reach out to the BRICS plus countries to actually provide services to enhance them, as you mentioned, to enhance the standard of living ultimately.
Yes.
Yeah, that's interesting. So just wanted to ask on coming back to the tanker situation that you mentioned. So even though these list of tankers, of Russian tankers, has been identified by Ukraine, the potential attackers could be non-Ukrainian, like, because I think that was what Russia has mentioned, right? The line, right? If you have NATO or other forces attacking, then it's all out, right? At that point, or they have a right to defend themselves. What are your thoughts there for that potential?
I think the Russians will try very hard to avoid giving NATO and allied Western powers any pretext to, let's say, invoke Article 5 of the North Atlantic Treaty and, you know, trigger a collective defense response where they say, like, okay, now it's all out and we're all going to war against Russia. Instead, I think that what they will try to do is do commensurate response. So if, let's say, a British submarine sinks a Russian tanker, which could happen, then maybe a Russian submarine might sink a British tanker, or, you know, a tanker belonging to a Western country that's right now unfriendly to Russia. And they might even do that through proxies. You know, they might provide adequate weapons to the Houthis in Yemen or other forces around the world and encourage them to use them on Western tankers. You know, always using the Western approach of having plausible deniability. But I think that, you know, at the same time, even if they avoid escalating the conflict, I think that it might exert pressure on oil prices. And so, you know, before the Biden administration is out, we might see oil prices rally higher than they are today. I don't know where, but, you know, it could be back towards $100 a barrel. Although, you know, my approach to speculation is trend following. I do not, you know, like, I may make a broad brush prediction about what might happen, but I don't want to suggest to anybody, oh, you know, it would be very clever if you went long crude oil. You know, this is, you know, we're exploring scenarios. I don't put much stock into a prediction. You know, like, every prediction is a 50-50 thing. Either it'll happen or it won't happen. And so, you know, I prefer to see a trend, a price trend forming. And then when we see the trend forming, then that's when you might think about going long. Not, you know, as they say, trade the news and lose your shoes.
Right. And in general, just from investors generally, like, how do you see the world evolving for investors in a multipolar world? So do you see it where maybe there's US-centric or China-centric type of countries and investments, and then maybe neutral countries that are sort of, you know, partnering or playing both sides, if you will, you know, countries like Brazil or Indonesia, maybe as being neutral. So how do you see that playing out from an investor perspective in a multipolar world?
Okay, so that'll depend on the kind of investing we're talking about. And it'll also depend the extent to which, let's say, the Chinese and Russian approach would be successful. They're not, at least overtly, they're not shooting for a Chinese-centric world. What they're what they're talking about is a multipolar world, and it is clear from Chinese conduct over the last few decades that they really are trying to do abroad in the global south what they have done at home, and they have lifted 850 million Chinese people out of poverty. And so I think that if they're successful, and then we also have, you know, from the Russian side, you know, one of the people who has been advising President Putin over the years, Sergei Karaganov, who has formulated is as follows. He said that our strategy is try to help transition the United States from the global policeman to a normal global power. And I think that what they want to achieve is to bring the United States on board as one of the poles of the multipolar world. So in that case, we're talking about the United States joining the rest of the world as a, you know, as a trading partner, as a, you know, one of the powers that's going to constructively cooperate with the rest of the world in creating the future. And I think that from this point of view, this would be I think a better future than the century of British geopolitics, because, you know, then this would be a boon to entrepreneurship, to people who create goods and services that could be exchanged with clients around the world, to the, you know, to everybody's mutual benefit. And so this could create an enormous lot of opportunities for everybody. In fact, you know, if you can create a widget in your garage today, you know, via the internet, you have unprecedented possibilities to reach to the whole world, you know, via the internet, using these various platforms like the social networks, to reach directly to potential clients and to fulfill their orders. So I have to mention that, you know, I'm not plugging this, but, you know, I just received a box of tea from India that I ordered a couple of days ago. Because, you know, if you go to a supermarket in the West, you know, the established channels of distribution, generally it's hard to buy good quality tea. No, it's starting to taste more and more like nothing much, you know, and then they start putting artificial flavorings in it. And so, you know, one day on my YouTube feed or Facebook, I forget which, pops up this commercial of an Indian company that's sourcing tea from local producer, packages them there, and ships them straight to clients across the world. So some Indian bloke who realized tea is crap around the world, and we have it here, why not? And then, you know, like, you get the package, and on every package it says, like, when the tea was picked, when it was packaged, and literally it was weeks ago. So, you know, this is an opening that didn't exist maybe 20 years ago. And I see that in the future, more and more and more people will be exploring these opportunities and finding value in the market. And, you know, if you have like 3 or 4 or 5 billion affluent consumers around the world, then think about what people who make whatever, you know, guitar strings, drums, things for, I don't know, clothes, apparel, makeup, whatever people buy. Suddenly, instead of having a relatively small market like your own country, or that, suddenly you can reach the whole world. So I think that from this point of view, it's going to be a different world, and there's going to be a lot of investment opportunities. And there's going to be a lot of space for, you know, angel investment and venture capitalist and people who can provide services in internet marketing space and things like this. I think those areas are going to be absolutely exploding. But it's, you know, it's not going to be as simple as saying like, you know, these stocks and these commodities, you should go and speculate on that. I think it'll be speculation suffused with creative energy and marketing potential and all of these things.
And what about your thoughts on the equities in the public exchange markets as things evolve? Do you see potential like capital exchange controls or restrictions, maybe, you know, for US?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. That's a good question. I think that's a, you know, right now, the capital markets are extremely important to the Western economies. Why? Because the asset, you know, all these assets form collateral in the system. If you allow the value of the collateral collapse, your whole credit cycle implodes on itself. And there you risk the economy going into that deflationary depression crisis. So we might see from places like the United States, we might see capital control where it becomes more difficult for American investors to invest abroad. But I don't see them closing off American capital markets to foreign capital. I think that there's something like $32 trillion in U.S. denominated assets in non-U.S. bank accounts around the world. And I think that with time, gradually, these dollars are going to be gravitating back home, and probably they're going to be going into the treasuries and into the equity markets. Now, you know, having said all that, for as long as the money printing cycle is accelerating and going full force, that's all going to be fine. As we talked, you know, the governments have to keep flooding. I mean, you know, governments and central banks, they have to keep flooding the system with liquidity to avoid it from grinding to a halt. So that tends to push asset prices up. But, and I mentioned, you know, Argentina, Zimbabwe, Venezuela, you know, we had this in Israel in 1986. We had this in Germany in the early 1921, 1922. The problem with this is that generally as this process unfolds, the increase in the cost of living tends to outstrip the increase in the rise of asset prices. So investors end up losing pretty much taking a total loss anywhere. And you know, empirical studies of inflationary episodes in market economies around the world since the 1960s show that usually in real terms, through the inflationary cycles, investors tend to lose 50, 60%, sometimes much higher. And in some of these extreme cases, the loss is pretty much converges on 100%, you know, everything gets wiped out. Example, in, I think in December 1921, the total market cap of the Mercedes-Benz company in Germany was equivalent of 327 of their cars. Okay, that was what the whole company was selling for. And I don't know this, but I suspect that they might have had 327 cars in their production lot and around dealerships around the country, which implies that the company was practically worthless at that point. So, you know, the nominal equity prices are probably going to be going up. But I don't think that investors should just relax and think that that's all dandy because so we win anyhow, because the collapse of the currency and the costs of living are going to outstrip those gains. So it's no good anyway. I strongly advocate for commodity investments because, and this is also an empirical fact, I'm not inventing this, far and away the most effective inflation hedge is exposure to commodity prices. Because, you know, as all these things happen, as the purchasing power of the currency goes down, you have the corresponding rise in the prices of commodities, and there you get a meaningful hedge. Whereas with the equities, you get a hedge that progressively loses pace with inflation and with the collapse of the currency.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, exactly. And what about for a U.S. investor? Could you see the potential for restrictions for U.S. investors to invest in Hong Kong shares, for example, in China?
I think that's conceivable. I think that's it's not on the radar yet, but we might come to a point where, you know, the government says, okay, we can't have capital fleeing. We can't have money fleeing our economy, and then impose restrictions on making investments in foreign markets.
Meet the Cedar Owl, a new economics and finance publication with a focus on environmentalism. We combine the Austrian School of Economics and market environmentalism principles for investing in a sustainable future. Follow the link in the description to get to know the Cedar Owl better, understand our values, our mission, exactly where we're coming from, and the type of content that we release on a cyclical basis every Thursday. Join us in targeting outperforming portfolio returns while making a positive impact on society and the environment through technology. Subscribe now for weekly insights, investment articles, and exclusive content.
And actually, further to that, you have all these regulated accounts in the U.S., you have 401ks in Canada, RSPs. I think Europe also similar type of regulated, registered accounts. Could there be a potential for forced investments, you know, by changing the rules to have 30% in federal government bonds, 50% in domestic industries that are identified, you know, different sectors domestically? You see that type of?
I think that's absolutely coming. You know, that's what they call financial repression, and you already have it escalating in the UK. Because I think that the crisis in Britain is the most acute of all the Western nations. That's my take. It's not really easy to figure out these numbers, you know, because for some reason for example, if you look at the US markets, you find loads and loads and loads of transparently updated statistics about the CPI, the PPI, employment, inflation, GDP growth, deficit, you know, budget deficit, trade. You can find everything about everything. With the UK, it's not really the case. It's kind of hard to read numbers, and then you find different sets of data depending on where you look. And so just this morning, you know, I read on X that British GDP shrunk by 0.1% in September 2024, and another 0.1% in October. Well, if you do a search online, you find all kinds of data that you can't quite tell where it's coming from, but they show you, oh, in September, British GDP was up 0.7%, and in October it was up 1%, and so it looks wonderful. And then I only managed to find these numbers by going to the British government national statistics office, and then downloading their Excel file, and then finding the actual, you know, the actual cells where they have September and October for. But it's, you know, like it's it's not easy to find. You have to work for that. If you find it easily, it's not the same numbers, and for some reason they look much, much rosier. Anyway, the British government is already putting pressure on pension funds to start allocating more and more capital into British government bonds to basically finance. And they want to consolidate the whole pension industry into just a couple of very, very large pension funds, because, you know, it's much, much easier to put pressure on 5 CEOs than it is to put on, let's say, 1,000 CEOs. And I think that the same is happening in other countries as well, in the United States. Only, you know, in the United States, it seems to me that it's being driven through private markets. You know, you've seen this process play out over the last 20 years, where, you know, 20 years ago, perhaps you had something like 20,000 hedge funds in the markets. And so you had 20,000 chief investment officers who decided where to allocate capital to. And then somehow, on the back of the Dodd-Frank Act, the regulation made it so that most capital started to gravitate towards the top largest 50 hedge funds. Thousands of smaller hedge funds went out of business, and the bulk of capital gravitated towards the big five, you know, the BlackRock, State Street, Vanguard, and these types of vehicles. And so now you have people from BlackRock and Vanguard who can be persuaded to allocate trillions towards US treasuries if the government needs people to participate in the auctions. You know, it's less totalitarian, but it has the same effect in the end.
And I suppose the last question would be, how do investors protect themselves against these type of trends that may not be in their interest fully? Like, do they go about assessing geopolitical risks, likelihood, and what investment or generic asset classes would make sense in this environment?
Okay, so that's a big question, but a very important one, because there are, you know, there are two sets of considerations there. One is, what do you do with your investable assets, with your liquid assets, right? If you want to preserve your purchasing power to the maximum extent, then I would definitely recommend strongly to seek exposure to commodity prices, right? So I'm not talking about buying shares of commodity companies necessarily, but you can use futures, you can use mini and micro futures, you know, if they're sufficiently liquid, and you can use also ETFs. There are ETFs there that give you opportunities to have exposure to cocoa prices, to copper prices, to energy prices, and so forth. I think that also people should not regard this as a way of striking it rich, of going for 10 baggers, you know, but to seek to preserve the purchasing power of their money to the maximum extent. Why? Because remember what I said, that as these inflationary cycles play out, the asset prices in real terms end up depressed. And as I gave you the example of Mercedes-Benz company, in some cases they go to pretty close to zero. So if you preserved your purchasing power to any extent, you will have phenomenal investment opportunities once the cycle unwinds. So again, you know, the best hedge against inflation by far is exposure to commodity price. The second best hedge against inflation is farmland. Inflation-linked bonds, equities, real estate, whether commercial or residential, those are not really effective effective inflation hedges. And in fact, they're not, you know, real estate is not a good inflation hedge at all. So those are not very good investment advices. I think that also everybody should have at least some gold and silver in physical form, you know, something that you can hold in your hand and bite into. And then there are other, let's say, defensive strategy, but that don't necessarily involve market speculation, but give you resilience to weather the crisis. And the most important one is get to know your neighbors, get to know the people in your community, because far and away the most important thing that will help you weather the crisis is to be able to rely on mutual help in your immediate community. And so, you know, you might have neighbors who know how to fix cars, who know how to fix leaky roofs, who can help you set up, I don't know, a virtual network or help you with your IT problems or electricity, whatever it be. So that is extremely important in these crisis situations. Then, you know, there are things like you want to be in good shape, you want to be fit, you want to know how to cook, you want to know you want to have a stockpile of non-perishable food, you know, things like beans and flours and sugar, tradable items like you know, coffee, tea, cigarettes, you know, even if you don't smoke, you know, a pack of cigarettes might get you some help from a corrupt government bureaucrat at a given point in time if you need something to be able to cut the line or something like this, you know. I've lived through, you know, I grew up in communism and I lived through hyperinflation in former Yugoslavia and then the war that followed. And so all of these things matter. You know, you can't necessarily envision today that they might matter, you know, like whether you have a pound of coffee to maybe give to your doctor or your dentist, or a pack of cigarettes to give to your car mechanic or things like this. But this might matter, and it's good to have these things on reserve. There, that's the advice that I can think of like this off the top of my head.
No, that's great. Great insight, and also a broad coverage in general. Yeah, for all aspects of life. And that's been great discussion. And how can our listeners and viewers learn more about your work, Alex?
So I'm easy to find on X. My handle is @NakedHedgy, and I'm active on Substack. I have two publications. One of them is for investors and traders. I provide a daily trend following newsletters with directional exposure and trading signals for 15 key global markets. And I also have a personal Substack called Alex Craner Substack, where I write about things of general interest, you know, including geopolitics and history and things like that.
Great. Thank you so much, Alex. Thank you.
Thank you for having me, and greetings to your viewers and listeners.
Great. Thank you.
Take care. Bye, Alex.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only. and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.